Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Global Supply Chain Practice Head for Morgan Phillips Executive Search. I am delighted to have with us today Sabine Müller, CEO of DHL Consulting. DHL Consulting is the independent strategic supply chain and management consultancy of Deutsche Post DHL Group, employing 120 consultants all over the world. Sabine has been dedicated to the logistics sector for close to two decades. After she joined Deutsche Post DHL, she took several roles as consultant, project manager, associate partner, after which in 2003, she was appointed SVP and head of the corporate organization. Starting from 2010, she's been the CEO of DHL Consulting. Together with her team, they passionately guide global logistics executives to effectively tackle and overcome supply chain challenges. In her own words, "As leaders, we cannot ignore the severe transformational changes this field is going through, which require us to rethink the way we do business. Digitization, big data, artificial intelligence, robotics, IoT, drones, blockchain, and the circular economy will redefine the supply chain and logistics ecosystem." Beyond her logistics career, Sabine also considers the advancement of women in executive roles to be a fundamental requirement for business success. She is personally committed to help female leaders succeed and promote more diversity in management teams. Without further ado, Sabine, welcome, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Hi, Radu.
Super. So I put together with the team the introduction for yourself, and to be fair, you've been, and I need to pay you this compliment, you've been one of our most sought after speakers. So the amount of questions we got on the social media, on the different channels, has been mind blowing, actually. So lots of people want to hear you and want to hear your thoughts, which is great. And actually, we had to streamline the questions because there were too many. So very glad that you made the time to be with us today. And maybe we can start by sharing with our audience a little bit about yourself and how did you end up yourself in supply chain and logistics and consulting, and a little bit about your story in the industry.
I think the introduction was very good. You already did, so there's not much to add. I ended up in supply chain somehow by incidents. So I started after university. I thought something complex is great, and I always liked solving difficult mathematical questions, and supply chain is difficult. So that's why I thought, just, I don't end up in consumer and retail like all my friends. So, and that's why I decided to start in logistics. And yeah, when I started, I wasn't sure for how long, but now it's more than 20 years. So I think the industry got me, and I'm trying to excite many people about logistics, because it's not about warehouses. It's not about packages only. It's about getting goods to customers, and it's really interesting.
Okay, and then can you tell us a little bit, Sabine, about DHL Consulting as well, and in terms of, you know, what it does within the DHL group?
So we are a management and supply chain consultancy with around 150 consultants around the globe, so based out of Europe, Asia, and the Americas. And what we do is around 80%, we consult Deutsche Post and DHL divisions in a lot of different areas. And 20% of our revenue, we consult external customers of Deutsche Post DHL, like big pharma, technology, automotive customers, to improve their supply chain. We will have our 20th anniversary soon. And we were founded like 20 years ago to, on the one side, reduce consultancy costs, because, you know, we are one of the big companies spending a lot of money with external consultancy. This was one reason, but the major reason was to have an area to attract talent, to have a very good point of sale for talents to join the group. What we do is teach them basic structuring and methodological skills. They all have the opportunity to see the different divisions and learn, and then we develop the people into executive positions of the group. So these are the two main areas. So one is consulting, drive change, and the other one is develop executives for Deutsche Post DHL. And both of it works pretty well.
Yes, actually, it's brilliant. I mean, it's strategically thinking, it's a very smart idea by DHL as a group to come up with. One, of course, lowering the cost of consulting, which is never cheap, and plus also building a very very smart and developed talent pipeline for the group. So interesting. And I didn't realize that you actually consult within the DHL group 80%. So that's quite a large proportion of your time, and about 20% externally. So I thought it's a little bit less, but yeah, great to know. And within, if we had to talk a little bit in terms of the main challenges that you see and you tackle with, right? Because as consultants, you tackle with challenges and with problems, and maybe within the DHL group, maybe within your clients. What would you say that right now are some of the major topics or hot topics and hot problems that your clients face?
So one is the whole change of automation. So changing and adapting to and automating the business, like warehouses, processes. So the whole digitalization part is a huge one, and as well driving the change in the organization that comes with it. So it's not only going in and bringing a bot to a warehouse, but also changing the processes, changing people's behavior to really implement the technology. So that's one part, and I think we will deep dive maybe later into this. The second one is still getting out cost. I think the logistics industry and supply chain industry is still a low margin industry, and I think it will never ever change. And being efficient, increasing our GP and EBIT has always been a big topic for us, and it's still there. So yeah. These are the two main things beyond the transition of the workforce and some of these topics, but I would also include them into the digitalization bit.
Yes. And we got a lot of questions, and I think that if there was a common thread around the questions that a lot of people was asking, it's pretty much summarized in the question from Amaury, who is working actually here at the Lazada Group, which is a major marketplace in Southeast Asia, as you know. And he was asking, because there's a lot of talk about all these disruptive technologies, you know, artificial intelligence, blockchain, robots, and all of that. But in reality, a lot of good old Excels are still handled by a low-educated team leader, and they're pretty pervasive, right? They're everywhere. So he was asking, what's your thoughts in terms of practically, what digital solutions are really applicable and mature today to boost up logistics performance?
I think there is a lot. So there are a lot of technology have matured in the last years that they can really boost our performance. So RPA is one where we use a lot of our back office processes, but also in our operations to automate parts of processes to improve quality, speed, and also reduce costs. But there's a lot of technologies as well in the warehouses, like various goods to men solutions, voice and vision picking, autonomous forklifts. We also work a lot on projects to implement IoT, because I do think IoT will also have a massive impact. For example, fewer redelivery attempts, more dynamic and customized delivery services, optimized shipping tracking. So these are all things that are enabled by technology, and it's there yet, and it's up to us and up to the divisions and up to our customers as well to implement it throughout the warehouses. And I think that's the most difficult one, because we have non-automated warehouses, and now the question is, how do we start automating them? Building up greenfield, a fully automated one, is much easier than just taking legacy and try how you are going to change it.
Yes. And if we were to go a little bit deeper, because this is a very interesting, I mean, deeper or more into examples, because let's talk about RPA, right? Robotic process automation. And it's a hot topic. It's something very practical and pragmatic. And before you talk about artificial intelligence and whatnot, I think RPA is here today, and it's more and more companies that are doing it. And maybe we can go into, without naming necessarily, if it's DHL or somebody else, but could you give us some examples of how and where you applied it, and if there was some pretty impressive cost saving or time saved, or, you know, what were some of the outcomes by using, for example, RPA?
So we applied in our invoicing process, and we looked at many processes and found parts of the process where we programmed a bot. And now we are our people are collaborating with the bot. So it's not that we have a full process automated, but a lot of the repetitive tasks are now done by a bot. So the people are doing the more valuable tasks, and the bot takes all the copying, looking in different systems. For example, if you want to see where your shipment is, that's something a bot can do. It's not necessarily a person who has to type in a number and find out where it is. So that's where we found, and we have a significant saving there. So in the process steps we look at, you can save up to more than 30% in time, or even much more, and also up to 30% in costs. I think what is very, very difficult, or where we really have to look at, what do we do with the people and how do we redeploy and teach or educate people so that they are now doing the more valuable tasks. Yeah, so APA will handle the repetitive tasks, and the employees focus more on exception handling or solution development. And this is where we do have to train some of the people in problem solving, in communication, to give them the opportunity as well to do the more value-adding tasks.
Yes, and I think that will be a very important topic of our discussion, because there were a lot of questions regarding, automation and what do we do with the people. So we'll get to that in the podcast. There was a lot of interest, and it's highly relevant. And I'm just wondering, also back to the point with the Excel, because there's a hard reality to the Excel and the use of Excel, which is still the number one tool most supply chain professionals use probably in the world, and for good reasons, right? It's useful, but at the same time, it has its limitations. But let's say that you became the chief supply chain officer of a major manufacturing company, and they were still highly deficient. The data was still in Excel, and you had two key initiatives to drive. I mean, of course, it's a very high level question, and it's without going into details, but what would you say that is the low hanging fruits that you would look at to optimize their supply chain, and what would be the technologies that you would look at first? Because there's a lot. You mentioned RPA, you mentioned a lot of things, but what would be your first steps?
So low hanging fruit would be RPA. So offshoring of all the repetitive tasks and tasks where you have to input data into systems doesn't have to be done in Germany in a terminal where we anyway don't have labor shortage. This is something that can be done either by a bot or on an offshore center. So I think what I would do first, go through the processes and offshore/introduce RPA wherever it's possible. And this would ease the process, increase quality, and also takes out a lot of costs. And I think these are low hanging fruits without investing in massive technology. Like whenever you go to automation in warehouses, you have to invest in technology. However, that's as well an area I would look in autonomous forklifts, things like this. It really makes a big difference.
Yes. Yes. And we had a question from Slav, which was kind of, it's a big picture question. It's like, and he's talking about digital logistics, right? So again, reality, still a lot of people are in Excel, but then he's asking, how about digital logistics? Because everybody's talking about digitalization, or used to be talking. Now they talk about artificial intelligence, but he's asking, what's the end game for digital logistics, and follow up, where's the disruption coming, and how do you see it?
Yeah, I think it's a very cool but difficult question. So what is end game? I think end game is very fancy. I think our warehouses will be fully automated. There will be no humans. I think we are close to the possibility to do it already. I think there's a huge change component behind it. And as I said, logistics is a very low margin business. I think we still need to find where the investments come from. But endgame, I would say most of our operations will be automated. That's one of the things. I also think that in an end game, if we talk about warehousing, you can also have a network of warehouses. So like we do have in Express currently, but like companies won't own warehouses. There will be providers, and the provider is a logistics provider, is like using the data the customers and we as logistics providers have, can predict where you might need the inventory, and then we can bring the inventory even earlier, closer to the customers. So you can also have warehouses in a network, and the cloud logic, what we currently have for data, can also be applicable to physical movements. So that's as well like something that's I see. I think the whole thing, if we look about the end game, we need to think, what about sharing economy? So I do see the new generation. I do see a lot of people moving more and more into sharing. So sharing cars, sharing bikes, but you can share much more things. And whenever you start thinking what you can share and how you would like to share it, it's logistics. There is logistics somehow involved. So the whole sharing economy is at the beginning, and we as leaders might think as well, like, what about sharing economy and how can we as logistics help with it? Same thing is urbanization. In many years, more than 2/3 of the population will live in cities, and I think you live in Singapore. It's already like difficult to really have the whole thing running in a city, and a lot of cities are close to collapse because of traffic, because of logistics, because of pollution. And I think that's also a big question where a disruption can come. And sustainability, I think that's my biggest thing. We need to think and rethink how we do things, because we all see that the importance of the planet and the climate change is something we as leaders as well need to think about and find solutions. So this is really big, and this is really thought like some years from today.
Yes. And if you are to go, I think in the closer future, there's a question very specific to how long before digitalization will help make the logistics process paperless to a large extent.
That's a good question. I guess closer
and a lot of people are wondering with the bill of lading and all of that. You have blockchain, of course, that is supposed to revolutionize everything. May or may not be the case, but I think it's probably an interesting question to get your view on.
Yeah, you know, I tried to get DHL Consulting paperless, and it took us 1.5 years. And we don't have any operations. We don't have Excel. We don't move goods. We are a consultancy. And it took us 1.5 years to be nearly paperless. And I think the problem weren't the IT systems. Problems were people don't want to change. And we are all used, it's so secure if you have the paper and you physically see it. So that it was the most difficult thing, even in like a small company of 150 people doing like more intellectual work, it took us 1.5 years to be paperless. So that gives you a little bit, a sneak preview how long it will take to get the entire logistics industry paperless. I think technically we can move. I think there are technologies out there, but I think it will take many, many more years before every single shipment is moved fully digitally in terms of all the backwards processes and the papers. However, I think freight platforms like the digital freight platforms and blockchain disrupt us and they push us. I think if you leave traditional logistics company, we will go on for the next 20 years, do it like we did in the last 20 years. However, I do think we need to be quicker. And this new small entrants, like the freight platforms, they really, really push us to change. And I'm happy that they exist, and I hope they will push us even further.
Yes.
So I think, yeah, that's something that will happen, and I do think it might happen earlier than we thought it will happen. And I hope that the small companies wake us up and pushes to paperless process. And I think with the paperless process and with digitizing some of the things, we will have a better transparency on prices, and the whole market will benefit from it, yes. And as well our customers.
Yes. And it's happening, like you rightfully said, it's happening. There's a lot of disruptors out there. There's a lot of platforms out there. There's a lot of private equity and venture capital firms investing in the field. We've seen some massive investments, which is basically just to say that it's bound to be disrupted. It's just a matter of time. And then we will see. But again, to go fully paperless, I have one of our close friends and connections is working for a large white goods manufacturer, and he went paperless. But again, it took a few years in his team, so it's not easy. It's not an easy at all an easy task to do.
And I think it's the same with the warehouses. It's much easier to build something up from scratch, and to build up a digital freight platform from scratch is much easier than having legacy and trying to move legacy systems, legacy processes into a paperless or a digital world. And that's a little bit what we as the traditional players are a little bit struggling with, and that makes things so, so difficult.
Yes. And a kind of a leeway into the next question, because we touched upon this at the beginning as well. And there's a good question from Max Sullivan, who was wondering, in terms of the question, what to outsource and what to develop in-house in terms of digitization project, which is a fundamental question, really. And it's a struggle always to kind of take this call, or it's not an easy choice necessarily. So what would be your thoughts in terms of what is so vital that you may really want to do it in-house, and what would you outsource to a third party?
Yeah, there's no real black or white answer to it, and it's a really good question. So what we differentiate, and maybe that's a good thing to start answering the question, we differentiate between a small, I recall it. So that's everything on automation. So small I, digitalization projects, less disruption, is everything where you automate. That's the whole thing we talked about. We talked about RPA, bots, autonomous vehicles, and all these things. And then we differentiate big I. So we said big I are new business models. So this is what really will disrupt our model. So will we have a forwarding business in X years, or will this be a digital freight platform? So what are business models that disrupt us? Or data, is data a new stream? How do we handle data? How can we, and I think there were some questions in the deck as well, like, we have the data, what can we do with it? So small I is automation, and big I is new business models. And if I would like differentiate, I would say small I is automation. There we work with technology partners, and I think that's very important. And I think you did a podcast with Matthias Heutke as well, who leads the whole innovation part. There we work with partners. So we work with partners to come up with autonomous vehicles for warehouses, or bots, collaborative bots or normal bots. And I think that's something where we work with partners to come up with the technology, or to invent or build the technology we then implement in our warehouses. And I think a lot of these implementation capabilities we need to have internally, because we need to scale, and we need to be able to really go into different warehouses to do it. So I think the thinking part is a lot with externals in the terms of joint venture or partnership model, and implementation internally. So I think it's very important, and we built this expertise the last years to have capabilities on RPA, Power BI, new work concepts internally, that you are not so dependent on externally. But on the other side, I think knowledge networks or skills bought externally is important there as well. And we in DHL Consulting as well have a mix between our own employees, and we work with externals to match the capabilities and find the right team for the right problem.
Yes. And what
for the big I, it would be different. So for the big eyes, so for the new business models, we work much, much more with external companies. So we have a partnership with Plug and Play, or in Germany, the Startup Autobahn, where we regularly meet startups, where we regularly interact with startups, where we screen startups together with the company to think about the disruption and think about, like, where's the change? Where's the new business model? What are things we need to try out? We also have this internally. We have a kind of a startup lab where we internally push ideas and invest in ideas coming out of our people, employees. However, for the big eye, I do see much more dependency and much more interaction or benefits of the interaction with externals.
Yes. It's interesting, and I remember when I was talking about Matthias, when I was in your innovation center in Troisdorf, and we spoke about the electric vehicle and he was telling me the story where you invested in the startup initially and you supported the startup, and I think now DHL actually owns a very significant stake, and DHL is obviously the biggest client of that particular startup, and you're rolling out and you're selling the electric vehicles to other postal operators in the world, which is a great example of how to kind of help build a startup and then help grow it as well and become a product in itself. So tell us a little bit about...
And then it also goes back to the whole sustainable aspect. I think we, as a huge company, as DHL, are also responsible to do something or to really focus on the emission topic.
Yes.
We all need to do something there, and we all need to put this as a priority on our agenda.
I mean, like you said, sustainability is one of the end games for digitalization, which I could not agree personally more, and I think a lot of people are very clear on that. And coming to the point with the startups and the ecosystem and ways of working with the startups, because there's always this kind of debate as well, and there's a lot of corporates that have tried it in terms of, okay, how can we disrupt ourselves? And that usually fails for a very simple reason, that people within the business find it very difficult to see how to disrupt themselves. It's like almost a paradox, right? They would not see it because it's maybe too obvious, but they're used to doing business in a certain way. And then what we've seen more and more, and it's the case also what you're sharing with DHL, and there's other companies that are doing it, they invest in startups or they incubate startups almost to disrupt their own business model, and then leave them alone so that it seems to work better in terms of creativity, innovation, and culture, because a lot of times it's very difficult to nurture this culture of innovation within an existing structure that is quite quite set in its ways already. And then basically the startup becomes an entity of its own and can take life of its own. So I'm just wondering if you can share, because I think the question was, how can you basically work best with startups, and how can you best cooperate, partner, incubate, take a stake, or what's your views on that? Again, very big picture question.
it's difficult, and I think we're still trying to figure out the right way to do it. I think as many big companies or corporations, we also tend to take the startup and put all our processes above it. So like investment process, these are rules. And this makes it very difficult for small startups to survive. So I think that's a difficult one, because we are so governed, and too much governance can kill startups. So that's the one thing. The other thing is what you said, it's left alone somewhere and we don't use the synergies. So the power of customer interactions, whatever we have, is not transferred to the startup. So I think both areas or both options are not good. What we did last year, I think it has been through the press. We have a new board department, and it's also headed by Thomas Ogilvy, who is our head of HR. It's incubations. So we have a board department where we say, this is an area where we incubate. And Street Scooter, that's the electric vehicle we just talked about, is one part of this incubation unit. And we want to see and develop a concept and as well see how we can fund it to incubate even more and better. Because you know how it is. Whenever you get pressure in terms of EBIT, in terms of results, and as I said, like logistics is still a low margin industry, the money for incubation or you spend into new ideas or try just shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. So I think it's always a discussion, and we are still discussing it in the board, how to set the incubation unit up. Yeah, and I'm happy if you have best or you have an experience you can or one of the listeners can share with me. But yeah, so currently we try to put money aside and to also do something and don't overkill the startup, but also see that they are integrated into a bigger cosmos or whatever.
Yes. Actually, there is a good example, and we had the CEO on the podcast. It's a company called Twill, which you may know is part of Maersk. So it's incubated by Maersk. And the story of Twill was that they kind of set it up in a basement somewhere in Berlin. So it was some sort of a hackathon in some ways. But Maersk has funded Twill all along. And the CEO had joined us previously on the podcast, and he shared a little bit the story, which is very, very interesting. But indeed, it was that fine balance, because now Twill is really gaining momentum. It's 2 or 3 years in, and it's gaining a lot of momentum, and a lot of clients are finding it very useful. But for Trolls, is the CEO, it was a fine line in terms of how to convince and how to keep getting the support from the management of Maersk when potentially at the beginning the results were not necessarily there, but luckily he managed to do that. And at the same time, they're working on those partnerships, clients, and so on to leverage on the group. So it, in some ways, it's almost like a very well taken care of baby of the group, but which is left alone to operate alone. So that makes it successful because it doesn't have to follow too much corporate governance and all of those type of processes. So they managed to, it's one success story that I know. There's not a lot, to be truthful, there's not a lot. I think there is, like you rightfully mentioned, there is this temptation or just reality of the big companies that they have a lot of governance and processes and compliance that they try to stifle. It kind of ends up stifling the startup, which is a challenge. But you know, in some ways, what I've also seen work in a couple of cases, specifically for Southeast Asia, where companies invest in a model that disrupts them, to a stake of 20%, 30%, 40%, not too overly, it's not to a point where they buy over, but basically they kind of investing in the future disruptor in their line. And then if something does happen and it picks up, then they can have a kind of a backup plan. So that also has worked. But typically what I have seen fail is indeed when the bigger MNC would try to put the culture inside the startup, then typically that would, or try to integrate too tightly the startup, then it would typically fail. And also just as another example, because you prompted me, I was, and I'm going to give them as a good example, ING, which as you know is a bank, right, is a Dutch bank.
Yeah.
They are number one or two or pretty much global leaders in trade financing. And they started a lab which specifically focuses on trade and logistics because they want to be able to offer their clients in trade finances, and obviously they're a financial institution, but they want to offer them also services related to maybe trade or logistics or compliance or other things. So they're investing in startups that offer that suite of services, and they are exploring how they can offer additional services to their clients. So it's the same suite of clients, different services. So again, very interesting model. I hope they will be successful. They've invested in a few startups already. Yeah, definitely a lot of people are trying it, more or less successful. So it seems to be a trend.
Yeah, I think with our new incubation unit, we try to just build what you just said, like a board member being interested in it. So like high level stakeholders in the group being really involved, and on the other side, giving them more freedom to grow as well, with not just putting them into like a divisional structure, targets, and so on.
Yes.
However, I think we need to ask ourselves always the question, which are the innovations we really have to drive, and where do we wait and copy with pride? Yeah, absolutely. So
it has to be practical. It has to be practical as well. So, yeah, it's a good point, and I'm happy that you were quite open to share it, because it is a reality. It is a reality of the business, and obviously, when you have the scale, you can also copy with pride. And I mean, we have a very, very clear example in nowadays social media, right? Instagram pretty much took a feature of Snapchat, right? So it's when Snapchat decided not to accept Facebook software to buy them, they basically copied certain features. So it's a fact.
And I think that's why some of the startups fail as well, because like, everybody waits until they have a really good idea that sells and then copies it. And I think that's cool.
Yeah, it works as well. And if you had to come back to the topic of skills and people replacement, and it's a very hot topic. I think that a lot of people are talking about it. You know, it's a reality. Artificial intelligence, RPA, automation, all these technologies that are coming up quite rapidly will displace people and will basically make away with certain jobs, usually low-skilled jobs, usually repetitive tasks. Usually, I like that phrase I think it was a phrase that RPA takes the robot out of the human, not the human out of the job. But basically what it means is, that repetitive, automated, mindless tasks will be taken away. So what do we do with the people? I mean, how will we, and I'm sure that it's a hot topic for debate also in DHL and also for governments, but what's your view on this if we had to go a little bit deeper?
I think on the one side, we already miss people. So we have in many markets like US, Mexico, and Germany, we are really struggling to get staff for our warehouses and terminals. You read about like truck driver. We are missing truck drivers. So in many countries, we are pushed to digitize or to automate because we really have problems to get people. So this is on the one side. And that's something we discussed with our Mexico team. That was like, Sabine, we need the digitalization. I don't like in Mexico, there's full employment. We are in competition with all the consumer and retail companies and we don't get the people. So we need to be quicker. So that's one of the things. So that's on the one side. So there's growth in the industry, and you know that the logistics industry is growing like hell and it will grow. There's a lot of growth in the industry and we might not be able to source for this growth. So automation will just help to solve this problem. So that's the first case. The second one is, yes, if we look like 10, 15 years, we need different skills. And I think that's where we as leaders, but we as well as company leaders need to start early. And I think something we are doing is we define employee clusters in our organization. For example, all people who deal with data processing. And then we trace the relevant technologies back to these employee clusters and say, okay, what clusters do we have? And what are the technologies that will disrupt this cluster or we can apply in this cluster? And then we like make a first hypothesis, how many jobs will be influenced and how we can upskill the people we don't need anymore to take over some of the other jobs that will evolve. Because with RPA, we will have people who train the bots. We will have people who look at security. So there are new jobs coming up with technology as well. So do we have people we can train and upskill for value-adding tasks? So what I said before in RPA, so then handling exceptions or talking to customers. So can I upskill the people for these skills or can I either upskill the people for a new job coming up? So that's on the one side. And I think that's something we really highly have to invest in. We have to start something like a lifelong learning concept, and we need to teach our people, and we also need to take the fear away from our people that change or technology is something bad. And we have to get into a modi where everybody learns on a continuous basis. So it's not like one or two days, like a classroom training. It's a continuous learning on the job every week, every day, to make the change. And we also need to be, and I think this is another thing, like we need to be clear what skills we need, we can't develop our people into, and go to the market and try to get the right experts for it. So this would be all the things on data scientists and where we really need to be in the market and see that we really go and source these capabilities.
I'm very happy that you mentioned that. For that, Morgan Phillips is an excellent executive search firm, and feel free to contact us. my 30 seconds commercial. but joke aside, though, maybe half joke, half reality. But it is in such high demand. Data analytics and data and machine learning and that type of programming skills have become in such high demand, and it's such cross industries actually. That we have seriously considered setting up a branch just doing that, and we are in the process of doing that, because that type of fundamental skill set will cross all industries, because it's all going to be about data, right? And that's why we're talking about this digitalization, so we have accurate data, and then we can analyze and improve and look at the processes within the organization and see what's working and what's not. But this data analytics and skill set is just fundamental, and it's so hard to find. And there's typically, it's almost like, you know, if you follow football or Bundesliga, if you have a Cristiano Ronaldo or a Lionel Messi, if they are available or on the market, there's 10, 20 teams that want to get them. So it's kind of the same with this kind of skill set. There's 10 or 20 companies that want to hire them. So it's almost a no-brainer. So, it's interesting that certain skills have become so valid.
But it comes back to like a question of our education system. And I think that's another. So I think we always talk very positive about it. So we have industry growth. That's true. We also can upskill our people. But on the other side, there are unskilled workers currently, and they won't have jobs in the future. So I think education training is something that's coming more and more. It's coming more and more important. And I think politics and also companies need to start earlier. So like, what do you learn at school today? Is it the right skills? Does school already prepare you for this? Do we get more data scientists educated? I don't think so. If I look at the German education system, it's still pretty much the same I had like 30, 35 years ago. So I think that's where we also have to push. And I think that's where politics have to push. But we as companies also have to push and say, like, don't we have to start earlier and change? Because the change is not taking 15, 20 years like it took years ago. Change is coming so quickly, and we don't have the time anymore to wait and discuss to react. I'm not sure how you see this.
It's an excellent point, and I'm very proud, and I think Singapore has or is coming close to finding a solution. There's other pockets. So I was speaking also to Yossi Sheffi, who's a part of the MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he's a very big advocate for online courses and online learning and making it available. And I think he's a whole. He's not very popular at MIT, but his whole kind of discourse is, look, why are we charging so much money for students to be in debt by the time they leave school? And it should be something that, one, it should be more accessible to people, that education should be accessible. And at the same time, knowledge is one thing, and basically learning stuff is one thing, but acquiring that skill or mindset of continuous learning is another thing. So you're spot on. I could not agree more personally. And what they're doing here in Singapore, and I'm actually thinking of getting somebody on the podcast to talk more. It's kind of like it's called a threefold agreement or threefold approach, where education and academia comes together with the government and the organizations, the companies, the MNCs, and basically gets their input on what type of courses, what type of skills, what type of curriculum, how do we make it more practical, and they actually implement it. So it's quite mind-boggling. And okay, Singapore also being small, I think they have a lot of, and they're very fast and they're very agile to implement it. So I've seen that in the 10 years that I've been here, and I've seen certain skill sets that didn't even exist, or even blockchain courses and stuff like that. They've started to have them the moment they became asked for by the MNCs. So I think it's that's something that more and more countries and governments and educational ministries should push for, this type of open discussion. Yeah. And like you rightfully said, don't wait. I mean, what's in there to wait? I mean, nowadays, you know, if you have Google, Wikipedia, you can pretty much, you know, train yourself on a lot of things, and you don't really need to memorize stuff. And unfortunately, I don't know, I come from Romania originally. In my country, it's still a pretty much, you know, kind of memorization on certain things, which is really, I don't find it useful at all. So, yeah, that shift has to happen in education, and that mindset of continuous learning, no matter if you're 50, 60, 70, whatever it is, because that's the way to stay relevant, really.
Yeah, and I think it's a big opportunity because there are so many new things, and you can be ahead of the curve instead of being one out of a lot with having the old skills. So I think people also need to see it as a chance or an opportunity and say, okay, I just go somewhere totally different, train myself, and just try out a fully new area.
Yes.
But change is difficult. And like, you know, like how it is. It's so difficult to take the fear away from people that change is something good, rather than they will lose their job, whatever. So that's also a big area we as leaders have to talk about. And I think we talk so much about technologies. We talk so much about IoT and all the technologies and how to implement them. We only take like 2% of the discussion. So like, how do we get the people there? How do we not lose them? How do we take the fear from the people that change will bring something bad to them? And I think that's something we still don't spend enough time on.
That's such an excellent point. And I remember I asked exactly or sort of the same question I was at a conference in Shanghai not too long ago, presenting. And then one of the speakers before me presented on all this transformation. I will not name the company, but it was, you know, the incredible digital transformation that they had done. And, you know, everything is wonderful. And I was like, you know, I was kind of a little bit skeptic, but okay, I listened through. And then I said, yeah, but it's interesting that you didn't mention at all about people, right? You mentioned how you implemented all these technologies. But, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, no matter how fancy your technology is, if the people will resist it, it will fail. So I, you know, I asked him, I would be interested, how did you do your change management? Because at the end of the day, that's what makes or breaks a transformation. So then he, you know, he made the point that indeed people were essential and all of that. But it's funny how so many companies, and I'm sure you've seen this over and over again, and especially in the consulting framework where you're external to the companies, they try to change the technology, but they really don't take care of the people. They don't take care of the mindset. They don't get people on board of why is that relevant and important, and how will it help them and the organization moving forward. And then of course it fails, and they are very surprised that it failed. And why did it fail? But it's kind of a one-on-one principle of fundamental change management and take care of the people to be on board type of a thing, right? So yeah, it's interesting. So but also kind of we actually had a question regarding you and talk about continuous learning and development, because obviously you're a busy person. You manage a company, you manage a large team. And Brita was asking, how do you manage to keep up with so many, you know, how do you keep learning, you know, so many use cases for digitalization, so many new trends, so many new things coming up, startups and so on and so forth. So how do you kind of manage to stay sane while reading, learning, working, researching, you know, consulting, managing businesses? So how do you keep a balance in all this?
It's a great question, and I think I haven't found the right balance. But I think where the change started was like 3-4 years ago, when like I started to just started with like social media and started to mix a little bit like work life and everything. So I started to read a lot on LinkedIn. I started Twitter. I started reading articles. Before, I said, like, these are the skills. And then I did like 80% classroom trainings. And I read like magazines whenever I had time, and then there was like a full magazine and you never really had time to read through it. So I started with smaller nuggets that doesn't bring you that deep, that's for sure. However, it keeps you up where the discussion is, and whenever you think that's something you can still buy, like buy a book or an article and deep dive. So the whole social media, the whole discussion brought me at least at where the pace is and where the discussion is, and much more to a level where I can talk with everybody. And then when I think, okay, IoT is something that's difficult, that's very important, that's something I deep dive. So that's one point. The second one is we changed significantly in DHL Consulting, saying we want to stay ahead of the curve and we would like to help Deutsche Post DHL in the whole digitalization automation area and push for it. And we would like to try things because we are a small unit. We are 150 people. We are all young. So if we can't change, how could a huge company change? So this helped me a lot. And in all our projects, I see and learn a lot. I forced myself out of my comfort zone to go regularly to conferences. That's where you also have good discussion on a Gartner conference. So there are many things. I still struggle how to put it all together, but I think that's where it started. And I would also like my recommendation to everybody would start small, start 10 minutes every day rather than wait for the time where you have a full or 2 days to go for a training, because that's what you will always postpone. So just don't postpone because you don't have time, just start small. And I think there are so many good concepts on micro learning where you have an app. So whenever you're at the doctor's and wait, you have 15 minutes, you can easily learn. So I, for example, use LinkedIn Learning on my mobile phone. So there are sometimes, or we wait for a plane. So there's sometimes time where you really can just spend some time to learn things and read things. And I think I'm a podcast junkie as well. So I like to listen to podcasts, and there are so many good out there, and every podcast gives you an inspiration or an information. So that's it.
Super. Thanks for the sharing. Your friend Charles Brewer wanted to ask the question about diversity, and it's a topic that I know is very close to your heart. And Charles is our friend actually, and he was asking, you know, in terms of diversity in the logistics sector, because it's been a sector that's been quite, let's say, mono-colored for a long time. Why is it taking so long, he's asking, and what should boards do to accelerate it?
Yeah, I think it's a difficult question because there's no single easy answer to it. Yeah, so it's not like this is a problem, you need to do this or this. It's a long journey. And I'm talking about gender diversity because, like, I think one of the first issues is that when we talk about diversity, we at least at DPDHR make it very broad. So we say, oh, diversity for us is gender, it's age, it's nationalities, it's background. So, and that's true. That's diversity. However, the bigger and more complicated you make it, the more difficult is it to measure it and improve it. So if I talk about diversity, in this case, I talk about gender, because I think that's still the biggest problem, or that's the biggest thing where we really have to improve. And I think the first thing where I think the problem starts is that we as management don't take it serious enough. And I think we talked about all the things going on in our industry, and we talked about all the targets to digitize, to improve margins, and there are so many things on our per agenda. There's so much pressure to deliver that forcing diversity is something we always put on. Yes, we need to do this as well. And it's nice to have, and we need to do it, but currently we don't have time. It's same with training. So, oh yes, I know that I need to do it, but I don't have time to do it. And I think if we don't change this, it will be really difficult to make a difference. If we don't hold our management accountable and say, like, let's measure improvements, or let's at least have a KPI measuring it, it will not happen, because I don't see any big difference in the last 10 years in terms of having women in executive positions. So that's one. On the other side, I've seen in my own organization, so I started around 10 years ago, and my management team was German. They were all German and they were all male. And they were all in the same age between, 35 and 40. And it took me 10 years to change it. So it's a marathon. So it's nothing you can change within like a very short time. It's like a continuous work. It's a continuous challenge of all the steps from attracting talent to select them, to retain them, and to promote them. And like, we work very hard on each of the steps. We had a huge bias in recruiting. So we had a process that was just discriminating more introverted or not so confident people. So we changed the whole process. We changed who interviews. We trained our people on this mini-me effect that people love to see people who are the same. So there were many, many measures we had to come up with a more diverse workforce. But if you don't push for it, it will not happen. Yeah. We last year we got 25% out of our 7,000 applications were female. So that's where it starts. So the industry seems not to be sexy for women. And if you have only 25% of the applications, that's where it's already start that you only hire 25 to 30% women, and this then will never change. So that's one. So one is, I think the management doesn't really take it seriously. But also I think we miss role models, and if we attract women, it's still a male dominated culture, and you work a lot with logistics. It's also sometimes not a female integrating culture. And like, I think we can talk hours about this. And I think sometimes women as well need to be bolder, more confident, and push themselves into like to be invisible. So yeah.
Yes. Really, like, it's a big topic. What I'm seeing, I mean, from a recruitment and executive search perspective, definitely it kind of resonates with what you're sharing. However, on the startups, and again, it's kind of normal, I guess, on the startups, and we work with the, when I say startups, it's companies that have received between 50 to 100 million or 200 million, and they're quite aggressive in their growth plans, but they do put this as a top priority, and they're, it's easier in many ways. It's the same, you know, when you start, like you rightfully said, when you start a greenfield project, it's easier to build an automated warehouse than to transform a brownfield project. So we do see a lot in the newer organizations that when they hire, they do hire with these principles in mind, and basically they're much more diverse from the beginning, which tends to be easier than the other way around. And at the same time, yes, what you said with the industry, definitely there's a bias in terms of gender resonance, just in, as in maybe in fashion, there's the other way around. Maybe 25% of the applicants are male and 75% are women. I'm not sure, right? But there's certain industries which have a certain preponderance, but I think it's improving. Overall, it's improving. And then we need examples like yourself, Sabine, and I think you're a very outspoken and good leader to prove and to kind of show that it can be done in a very good way. And that's also important, to have role models, isn't it? So I think that's key. And also, yes, senior management needs to, and some of these boards, let's not name anybody, but some of these boards definitely need to make sure that they have some more women in the boards and that they're more diverse. So I think that will bring a lot of more different opinions and different ways of doing things, and maybe also that pressure towards only money, bottom line, and delivery might be a little bit better in terms of integrating it with also taking care of the people side. So being a little bit ambitious and maybe illusional, but I think it would help. So yes, I'll close that topic for now, because indeed we can talk for hours on that. I wanted to kind of start wrapping it up, but I wanted to ask you, in terms of, if you were to look back in your career, and you've had a very very fruitful one, and you've been for a long time with DHL. What would be one or two pieces of advice that you received that you would want to share with somebody listening to this podcast, maybe starting in their own careers, and that really helped you become obviously very successful and now the CEO of a very important business in DHL?
Yeah, I think the one that really personally helped me a lot was that somebody told me that I need to move out of my comfort zone. To grow, you really need to push yourself into an area like where you fear to go. So we always said, like, that's your comfort zone. Then you have the learning zone. And if you go out of the learning zone, you have the panic zone. So you need to push yourself close to this panic zone. And I think that's where you really grow. I think that's something that helped me a lot. And I tend to, and I think a lot of people tend to stay in the comfort zone because that's nice. Yeah. That's where you feel comfortable in. That's where you are good in. However, I think that's something that was really, really, that really made a difference to me. And the second one is something I needed to learn because I was just raised and grown up differently. And that's the one: you get what you have the courage to ask for. And I think I sometimes should have told people earlier what my vision would have been. And even if it's bold, because that's what people do, and I think that's great. And I think that's coming back to the gender discussion, that where women are not so good in as men, just be bold. I said, like, I want to do this job. Yes, I'm not ready yet, but like, keep it in mind. I want to be a CEO over there, and I want to take over this one. Even if it's five steps too far, it just sticks. Rather than saying, oh yeah, no, I have to go back and maybe I have to learn here a little bit, like, be bold and ask for what you want, and you will be. I'm always astonished how much you get if you have the if you ask for it.
I will be very curious, and I'll just and I think it's also for the benefit of the audience. And it triggered me when you said this also in terms of having the courage. And I remember that we had another great female leader on our show, Roxanne Deshmish, who's the head of supply chain for Infineon here in APAC. And she was saying that a male would apply for a job being 60% ready for it, whilst a female might wait until she's 120% and then apply for a job. And it made me wonder, because at that point in time, I didn't really think about it. Also me being a guy, right? But it kind of made sense in retrospect, and also based on my experiences afterwards. And it kind of links to your point that you need to be bold, right? And you need to ask for what you want, and you need to tell people what you want. And I was thinking, maybe can you give one example of where it made a lot of difference for you in your career, so that we make it, you know, it would be, I mean, I'm curious, basically. I'm very curious to hear.
General, for my career, I think going back to consulting and taking over DHL. So I've been in consulting. So I started as everybody after university. That's where I learn a lot. Then I went into the line function, and I found out that I think I would love to take over the lead for DHL consulting. And I told my boss at that time that that's what I think I can do, and that's what I would like to do. And then it like happened like a year or 1.5 years later. So that was one of the things. It took a while, but I'm not sure if I would have been considered, because I left as a successor, if I would not have told anybody before. So that's one of the examples.
Yes, and it's a good example, and a lot of times people just assume or pray or I don't know hope that that somebody would read their minds, or they would realize what they want without saying it, or without making it specific, or without asking for it, as you rightfully said. So it's really,
some people think if they do a good job and they excel content wise, they will recognize and be promoted. And that's not how it mostly works. I think you work in this field, and I think excelling and doing a great job and going the extra mile is great, but sometimes it's not enough.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's the bigger the organization, of course, it's about people. It's about relationships. It's about the way you conduct yourself. And of course, it's about having results. So it's a kind of a combination. And indeed, some people are maybe a little bit unifaceted, but it's all of this that come together that make a successful career, because it is ultimately about people, people skills. So great point. And Sabine, thank you for your time. Thank you for your sharing. It's been some excellent examples, and I hope and I trust that that this will be one of those podcasts, like you mentioned, that people will listen to and find it valuable. And I really appreciate also your straightforwardness and openness to share some of the, because there's been some quite hard topics that we discussed about in a very open manner. So I really appreciate that. And look forward to the next sketch up, and then keep up the good work at DHL Consulting.
Thank you so much, Radu.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radupalamariu.com/podcast for all the show notes, links, and extra tips covered in the interview. Make sure also to subscribe to our emailing list to get the news in the nick of time. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes or Stitcher and you like what we do, please kindly review and give us 5 stars so we can keep the energy flowing and get more people to find out about our podcast. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest articles as well as future guests for the podcast. And if you have any suggestions or any other idea, please feel free to write to me. I respond to all. And also, please make sure not to miss our next episode, where we will be having a few other C-level and top leaders in supply chain joining us. Stay tuned.